right, friends, Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason, and glad to chat with you today. I'm kind of distracted at the moment because I'm trying to get a document out of my trash so I can open it up and look at it while I'm talking with you. Just a reminder, for those of you who live in the Los Angeles area, specifically the West End or the Northwest area, a lot of folks don't realize that the coast does not go north and south in Southern California. It goes, in some cases, almost straight west, but generally kind of northwest, southeast kind of thing. So when you get into the San Fernando Valley north of Los Angeles, you could travel a long way straight west and still be on terra firma. Okay, and that's where I live, out there west of the Conejo Valley. I'm sorry, west of the San Fernando Valley in the Conejo Valley. And coming up tomorrow now from the day that this broadcast will be released, that would be September 11th, Saturday, I'll be doing a special tactics seminar at Calvary Westlake Church there in Westlake, and from 9 in the morning till 2 in the afternoon. When I say 9, you got to be seated in your seat at 9. That's when I start. So best get there at 8:15, 8:30, sign up, whatever. And if you want to sign up, just go to calvarywestlake.org and scroll down to the bulletin. Hit the bulletin button and read the bulletin, and there you have some detail about the event this weekend. Hope that's still there. That would be last weekend's bulletin, but in any event, love to see you there. It's one of the rare opportunities that I have in my own community to teach and do an event, and it's just, what, 3 or 4 miles from my house. So that's just right. That's almost jogging distance back when I used to jog. Don't do that anymore. I don't walk that much anymore. Legs don't work too well. But in any event, love to have you show up for the Tactics Seminar 9 to 12 at Calvary Westlake. And go to calvarywestlake.org and look at the bulletin there as you scroll down and the information is there. Now, with having said that, you know that Tim Barnett is the brainchild behind Red Pen Logic, and I hope that you guys have been enjoying those. And Tim is getting overloaded with requests and opportunities because of the kind of deceptive foolishness that is being touted as intelligent responses to weighty spiritual or moral issues. And so we work together on these. He finds them, or they're sent to him, and he works on them, and then I go over the text. And it just, it's amazing to me the kinds of things that people think are solid, are sound, are good. Thumbs up. Gotcha. Boy, did you give it to them. That was really smart. Here is a meme that has actually now been posted on a Red Pen Logic and answered from Jamila Jamil. And my apologies if I'm butchering her name. She's an actress and a British actress and a model, etc. But apparently she has a lot of clout in the world, because when she posted this particular piece, she had 223,663 likes. That's almost a quarter of a million. That's pretty impressive. Okay. But what she was doing was she was campaigning for a different way of characterizing the pro-life movement. She doesn't like that word. She thinks it's deceptive. And so in her meme, she is offering an alternative. So let me just read it for you. And when I read it, I think some of you are going to think, yeah, I don't like that. I don't agree with that. But then you're going to say, but I don't know how I could answer it. I don't know how I could show what's wrong with it. Now, of course, this is why we do Red Pen Logic, so that we can show you what's wrong with it. You can see what's wrong with it and not be taken in by it, but also at the same time, hopefully, get kind of instructed as to how this kind of thinking works. Incidentally, I mentioned Red Pen Logic. Just go to YouTube, type in Red Pen Logic, you're going to get it. It's easy, it's fast. Okay, and then you can subscribe. I'm not even sure how many subscribers we have. I don't want to look something up right now on my computer because I'm using my computer to do the show. I don't want to hit the wrong button and then lose all of you. But go to YouTube, type in Red Pen Logic, and you have it. And the most recent one is Tim's response, posted today or maybe yesterday, I think, to this piece. Now, here's what she says. Not pro-life. Pro-forced birth. That's the correct terminology for anyone who discards the life, health, mental well-being, survival, and freedom of the living, here referring to the mother, for the unborn, who they will then equally disregard the human rights of once born. Now, there's a lot going on here. I want to read it one more time just so you can kind of let it sink in. Not pro-life. In other words, she's taking exception with our language. She is going to relabel this in a way that she thinks is more appropriate. So notice what's going on here. This is a rhetorical move to put a different label on our view that she thinks is more accurate to the facts. And incidentally, there's nothing wrong with that. Part of what we're doing in It stands to reason, and in dealing with these Red Pen Logic memes, is to unveil the rhetorical ledger domain, sleight of hand, shell game that's going on. Shell game, you know, three shells with a bead under it, and they move it around. You got to try to find where the bead is. That's what shell game means. It's sleight of hand. It's trickery. Now, she thinks there's trickery here in the language, not pro-life. That's not the right way to characterize it. Rather, pro-forced birth. That's, she says, the correct terminology for anyone who, now, this is the claim that she's making against pro-lifers. For anyone who discards the life, health, mental well-being, survival, and freedom of the living for the unborn, in other words, on behalf. So the ones that are alive are being jettisoned in these ways, characterized by those words, in favor of the what? The unborn. Who, she continues, they, pro-lifers, will then equally disregard the human rights of once born. So not only do pro-lifers not care about the mother, we don't even care about the baby once the baby is born. There it is. 223,663 likes. And underneath, she's got a little line. I don't know how they do this. She says, I beg that we ban pro-life as a term for these expletive deleted ignorant monsters. The expletive isn't ignorant. It is an adjective describing ignorant. But we're the monsters. The pro-lifers are the monsters. Now, that's pretty powerful. It's powerful in that it's rhetorically compelling, rhetorically tricky, and rhetorically deceptive. So let me unpack this a little bit for you. The way Tim has done nicely in his piece, you can check it out. I hope you do. But I want to talk about it because I want to protect you from deceptive foolishness. I want to protect you from lies. What this issue is about is whether or not it is okay to destroy innocent human beings while they are living inside the wombs of their mothers. Now, that statement has not a shred of rhetoric in it. Every word I used was a fact. Abortion kills an innocent human being. Pro-lifers aren't against capital punishment because those human beings aren't innocent. But in this case, the unborn human being is innocent. An abortion is an active effort to kill that human being while resting in the womb of his or her mother, where she or he belongs. Okay, so there's no rhetoric here. This is just a bare bones description of what's going on. But notice when I just offer the bare bones description, it already sounds a little ugly and nasty, which is why people are going to object to that description. But what is distortive about what I just said? Nothing. So Jamila thinks that pro-forced birth is the correct terminology. And the fact is, no, it's not correct. It's deceptive for a number of reasons. One, it erroneously describes those pro-lifers who are trying to prevent the killing of unborn humans. Back to our facts again. All right? We aren't forcing women to do something. We aren't dragging women out of their homes and injecting them with fertilized eggs so that they have to carry to term against their will. Those babies in the wombs of mothers were produced by the mother doing the things that naturally produce babies. No one's forcing, I guess in the case of maybe rape. But we'll just set that exception aside here because that's not an exception that's in view. The fact is, pro-lifers are not forcing women to do something. We are telling them, rather, not to do something. That is, do not kill your unborn child. Now, is that unusual? No. We restrict behavior all the time that endangers the lives of others. We're restricted to 25 miles per hour in a school zone. Okay, that's a restriction. You can't go faster than this. Why? Because you're endangering kids. We want to protect the lives of those innocent children. Therefore, it says 25. You can't go faster. Nobody's forcing. Yeah, I guess you could say they're forcing me, but to go slow. But you see, this kind of thing we do all the time. We restrict all kinds of choices because there's a greater issue involved. In this case, the unborn. Now, she says for the unborn, but the word unborn, is there an adjective used as a noun? Unborn what? What is the adjective unborn describing? You can't say fetus because it's not always a fetus. Sometimes it's a zygote, all right? So sometimes it's a blastocyst. Or I hope we got the word right. But the point is, these are just phases of development of something else. It's an adolescent. Adolescent what? I almost hit an adolescent deer yesterday. It darted in front of my car. Mister, it, adolescent, I don't know which one, male or female, didn't matter. Adolescent what? Unborn what? Human being. That's the it in question. But she doesn't say in human being because that would not work in favor of the rhetoric. She just says the unborn. So the claim here is that we should say pro-forced birth because we are forcing people to do something that they don't want to do, and that is give birth. But of course, we're not forcing them to give birth. That whole process was initiated by the mother and another male, the father. All right? All we're saying is that human being that is developing inside, you can't kill. We restrict the behavior. Okay? Here's the second thing. Abortion is actually the force option. Abortion is, and here I'm not playing rhetorical games, it is literally forced death. So a pro-abortion person is pro-forced death. Why do I say that? Because every abortion uses deadly force to kill a human being. It floods the vagina or the uterus with caustic fluids that can burn and eventually kill the child. They penetrate with, they go in invasively with scalpels and knives and cut the baby into pieces and then take the pieces out. They scrape the uterus with a tool to scrape away the young human being. That's the force option. They're forcing their way in to take the life. And what's so ironic here about this characterization of pro-lifers who, according to Jamela, discard the life, the health, the mental well-being, survival, and freedom of the living. Well, wait a minute. The unborn is also alive. The unborn human being is alive too. And to ask a mother to carry her child, and I use the word child because that is the word that mothers use, of their unborn inside them whenever they want it. When is your child due? How far along is your child? Oh, my child kicked me this morning. Oh, my child's moving now. Yes, it's your child. The pro-lifer is not discarding the life and the health and the mental well-being and survival of the mother. In some ways, I guess, the freedom, but that's the freedom that's lost whenever anyone is a parent. Because parenthood entails moral obligations to the offspring we have produced, even when we have produced them without choice. That is, we didn't choose to produce offspring. May have chosen to have sex, but we didn't choose to produce offspring. Nevertheless, it doesn't abrogate your, doesn't release you of responsibility for that child. But pro-lifers aren't discarding the life of the mother. Pro-lifers are willing to help the mother. It's the pro-abortionist, the pro-forced death group that are the only ones discarding the life, the health, the mental well-being, the survival, and the freedom of the living child in that child's mother's womb. So this is a huge lie. This is meant to make something monstrous look noble. And in fact, the real monsters are those who promote lethal force to butcher babies in the womb. That's where the word applies, not to pro-lifers. And the third point that Tim makes here is that the pro-life people care deeply about all humans, born or unborn. Incidentally, if all we were doing were fighting for the life of the unborn and didn't do anything else, it would be a noble enterprise. Just like it's noble to campaign against wife abuse, even if you're not willing to marry the woman yourself. But Christians do much more than that with regards to the abortion issue. My wife worked at a CPC, a crisis pregnancy center. That's where I met her. And I was giving a talk to raise money for the CPC when I met her. And I've done dozens of fundraising events like that in the past for CPCs. Why? Because pro-lifers are coming out of pocket generously and sacrificially to give money to care for the woman and the child who is the result of her choice for life. Is Planned Parenthood doing that for those women who choose to carry? No. Is Jamela, Jamil, doing that? I don't know, but I doubt it. Is she giving money to crisis pregnancy centers to help women who choose to carry to term face the obligations that are challenging for them in light of that choice to take care of that human being once that human is born? I doubt it. Pro-aborts don't show up at CPCs to give money. It's rather Planned Parenthood who makes profit on abortions and gets tax money. Actually, there's more nonprofit pro-life crisis pregnancy centers in the United States than there are for-profit pro-forced death centers. So when Jamela says who they, referring to the unborn that are saved from abortion, who they then equally disregard the human rights of once born. This is just nonsense. This is false. This is a lie. This is slanderous. Well, so much for the instruction here. I got another point I want to make very quickly because there's another side to this. This person here, Jamil, and again, my apologies if I'm mispronouncing her name, she is free to post this without fear of retribution. And what she posts is quite aggressive. As I mentioned, she calls pro-lifers ignorant monsters, and I didn't even cite the expletive that I deleted, the nasty word, the adjective. This is pretty strong, all right? Now I want to read something else. This is just a tweet by John Gibson. Some of you know that Texas just passed a law that banned abortion if the baby has a heartbeat. And the Supreme Court of the United States of America, SCOTUS, decided not to hear the case, the objection to this law being activated, so to speak. And so in other words, this law stands for the time being. And this is a great victory for pro-life, and it also signals a changing sentiment in the Supreme Court. John Gibson, whose identity I'll clarify in just a moment, tweeted this, "Proud of U.S. Supreme Court affirming the Texas law banning abortion for babies with a heartbeat. As an entertainer, I don't get political often. Yet with so many vocal peers on the other side on this issue, I felt it was important to go on the record as a pro-life game developer." By the way, when he says so many vocal peers on the other side of this issue, Jamila Jamil is one of them. Okay? So everybody gets to speak their mind. Right? And by the way, this was tame compared to the meme that I read you that we critiqued on Red Pen Logic. This is tame. Proud of the Supreme Court affirming the Texas law banning abortion. I don't speak out too much, but I thought, well, everybody else is talking, so I'm going to talk out. This man lost his job. What was his job? He was a CEO. A CEO, Chief Executive Officer. That's like right at the top, right? Of what? He was the Chief Executive Officer of Tripwire. Now, I don't know what Tripwire is, but I bet you a whole bunch of you recognize this. And in this particular news release, Tripwire appoints new interim CEO Alan Wilson as company moves forward. And the piece says the comments given by John Gibson, which I just read, are of his own opinion and do not reflect those of Tripwire Interactive as a company. Okay, fair enough. Good. Oh, his comments disregarded the values of our whole team. What, you mean he disagreed with some others? Yes. Our partners and much of our broader community. Okay, so he's a lone voice. Okay, good enough. Our leadership team at Tripwire are deeply sorry. What, you're apologizing for him? For that? What I just read? And are unified in our commitment to take swift action. And to, and watch this, foster a more positive environment. Let me read that one again in case you missed it. Now they're apologizing to all these people because there was a guy, their CEO, who said something in a tweet that was against their view, and he wasn't even unpleasant about it. Oh, my goodness. Help us. They couldn't say God help us, so they just got to say help us. We are deeply sorry, and we are unified in our commitment to take swift action. What action? Against him. And to foster a more positive environment. Really? So when you can somebody at the top of your organization because he has an alternate viewpoint, that's going to foster a more positive environment? Please. This is rhetorical ledger domain. This is what I've been talking about. It continues, effective immediately. John Gibson has stepped down. I'm sure he has stepped down. Please. He just said, you know, I'm not interested anymore being CEO of Tripwire Interactive. No, you guys are committed to take swift action. That's why he's not there anymore. He didn't just step down. He was jettisoned. And then they mentioned the personnel in Wilson who is taking his place. And it says the team that it now is going to take steps with employees and partners. I mean, this was so rattled the organization that one person, John Gibson, at the top of the organization would offer this mild statement in support of the United States Supreme Court's decision. That's the law of the land. They are so rattled that they're going to, quoting again now, take steps with employees and partners to address their concerns, including executing a company-wide town hall meeting. And watch this. And promoting open dialogue with Tripwire leadership and all employees. Are you kidding me? Do you think any of us is going to believe this nonsense? That you can the CEO for this modest statement in support of the unborn? And you are now asking for open dialogue? You see what's going on? This is called soft totalitarianism, friends. You don't need the government swooping down and taking away your rights. All you need to do is have an employer that is willing to fire you if you express anything in public that is inconsistent with their personal politics. You're out. Your job is over. I'm trying to remember the name of the guy over was it Firefox or, no, I can't remember it. Same thing happened to him. He got canned because he gave some money to Prop 8 in California years ago, which was in favor of traditional view of marriage. He gave $2,000. And when they found out that 5 years prior, Mozilla, that's it, the organization was Mozilla. He was the CEO of Mozilla. That 5 years before that he had given money to Prop 8, they canned him. Again, and he stepped down. No, he didn't. He was kicked down the stairs, just like John Gibson was kicked down the stairs at Tripwire. I don't know what Tripwire is. I don't play games. I'm not a gamer kind of thing. But maybe you are, all right? This is the kind of organization they are, just so you know. You can make your own decisions about their products, just so you know. I'm not making this stuff up. This stuff is happening everywhere. And I told you last week, please be alert. for the issue of Solid Ground that came out September 1st. Now it's out. You may have received it. Maybe it's coming in the mail through snail mail for you. Maybe you haven't signed up. Go to our website, sign up, upper right-hand corner, subscribe. It's free. And this one you can just check out on the website or on our app. It's called The Evening News. This kind of stuff is happening everywhere. It's bullying by the anti-bully crowd. It is hate by the anti-hate crowd. It is intolerance by the tolerance crowd. It's all nonsense. It's all a scam from these people. It's their way or the highway, and they will punish you for having an alternate view. Does this help? The unborn? No, he gets fired for being happy that innocent children's lives were protected. Look, in a few days, actually, when you get this, tomorrow, September 11th, 20 years from 9/11, 2,977 people died in 9/11. Time magazine, I think, said the greatest loss of human life since the Civil War in one day. Not true, because 2,977 is approximately the same number of children that are killed in America through abortion every single day of the year for the last 48 years. We've had a 9/11 every single day. And God bless John Gibson. May God prosper you, John. May he protect you. May he provide for you for being willing to stand up. It sounds like you probably misjudged your colleagues. You thought they were more tolerant than they turned out to be. You thought that they were more gracious and charitable than they turned out to be. You thought they were more loving than they turned out to be. May God take care of you. And I thank you for your courage to stand up to brutality. That's what abortion is. It is brutality. All right, let's take a break, and then we'll come back to your calls on Stand to Reason.
Did you know there's a new argument that attempts to use frogs to prove that God didn't create only two genders? Find out what that argument is and my response in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Look for it on iTunes, your favorite podcast app, or at the top of the homepage at str.org.
Friends, if you like this broadcast, I know you'll love hashtag STRask. It's our shorter 20-minute podcast where I am paired with the wonderful Amy Hall, and together we answer the questions you send us on Twitter. Hashtag STRask is released twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, and it's only about 20 minutes long, so it's perfect to listen to on your morning jog or while driving around running errands or cleaning your garage or just plain loafing at home. Amy and I tackle your questions on theology and ethics and culture and lots more, offering our insight on the questions you're asking or the challenges you face. You can listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your own shows. Just remember, send us your questions on Twitter using the name of the podcast, hashtag STRask. That's hashtag STRask.
As a high school teacher, I always had a red pen close at hand. When I wasn't in front of my students teaching a lesson, you could find me assessing assignments, grading essays, and evaluating exams. The red pen played a crucial role in the educational development of my students. With it, I questioned their assumptions, exposed their errors, and challenged them to think critically. You see, a good teacher doesn't merely tell his students that they're wrong. A good teacher shows his students why they're wrong so they don't make the same mistakes twice. He corrects because he cares. Last year, I was scrolling through social media, and frankly, I was discouraged at all the bad thinking that undergirded much of what I was reading. Then it hit me. What if someone applied the red pen to this flawed thinking? And Red Pen Logic with Mr. B was born. In the last few months, Red Pen Logic has grown in popularity. Through our engaging and shareable educational graphics and videos, we are helping people, especially young people, assess bad thinking by using good thinking. And we have a lot of fun in the process. So here's your homework assignment. Like the Red Pen Logic Facebook page so you don't miss our next graphic. And subscribe at the Red Pen Logic YouTube channel so you don't miss a single video. Class dismissed.
So that was Tim with a timely promotion of RPL. I suspect it was not an accident. Kyle, the sly one. All right, let's go to Rochelle, Washington, which is apparently near Seattle. No, we're going to Washington near Seattle for Rochelle, right?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can. Rochelle. I thought Rochelle was a city and it was a person. Okay, we got you.
It's a city somewhere. So first, I just want to say thank you for your ministry. I've been listening for about a year and a half, mm-hmm. and it's been wonderful. I also read Tactics, and my question really is about at what point, and I know you've talked about this before, at what point do you leave a church? Mm-hmm. Because, long story short, I've been a professing Christian for basically my entire life, but really didn't come to true saving faith until 2019, mm-hmm. when a friend of mine sent me American Gospel, and through that, I started reading my Bible, and then I read another gospel by Elisa Childers, and I read your book, Tactics, and then I read Chosen by God by R.C. Sproul, and that was it.
Wow. So let me just for clarification, did you say that Elisa Childers' book was significant in your coming to Christ?
Yes, I do.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that. And I'll tell her that because she's a friend and she's been on the show before and actually just saw her 2 weeks ago. Excuse me. But next time I see her, yeah. I want to make a point that I talk with
her
someone that came to Christ.
American Gospel. Yeah.
Yeah.
Her
okay, good. That's good
American
news.
Gospel was really pivotal.
It's a wonderful book. It's a wonderful book. Another gospel. Very, very important one.
And so, as I was reading my Bible and as I'm reading these books, I realized that I had just proclaimed that I was saved, and my life did not show that. I lived however I wanted to, mm-hmm. up until 2018, and that's when my heart changed.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I had been going to the same church for about 16 years, a church with a pastor, and I want to be really, really careful. My pastor preaches the gospel. However, this is a Assemblies of God Pentecostal church. So theologically and methodologically, if that's a word.
Okay.
There are things that I really struggle with, and I know from reading the word that I'm called to be a part of fellowship in the body of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to stay in this church, and as far as the word that's preached, it's biblical. It doesn't change the person or the work of Christ. However, when I get involved in small groups, when I look into youth ministry that my son is going into, he's autistic, so I have to be really careful because he takes everything very literally. I just run into so many issues that violate my conscience that although the gospel is true and is being preached, there are so many issues that I struggle with that I at times I just feel like I need to find another church.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said there are issues that, just to for clarification for me, you said there were issues that violate your conscience. Do you mean that they actually violate your conscience or that you just disagree with them theologically?
Well, I don't know. Maybe I need clarity on that, because when I hear people talk about Jesus, like all you need to do is accept him, I don't know if that's, I don't believe that that's the way salvation, I don't believe that's the order of salvation.
Sure.
I don't believe it.
Okay, well, that's a theological issue more. I mean, a violation of conscience is when you are enjoined to do something you think is wrong. According to your understanding of right and wrong, you are being asked to violate your standard. So, that's a violation of conscience. What you just described to me sounds more like a theological issue. And it's okay. I just wanted to be clear on what you had in mind there.
That's one. Another one is, for example, like singing certain like modern Christian songs that call God reckless, which I don't read the Word of God and see a reckless God. I see a sovereign God. So I can't stand there and worship God calling him reckless.
Okay. So I think I got a pretty good picture here, Rochelle. And let me just give you some feedback on this. I think your Christian community should be a spiritual home for you. Okay. And if you got something to write on, just write that word down, the word home. All right.
Okay.
Now, the reason I think this is a helpful word to think about regarding what you're facing is because there needs to be, of course, in a body of Christ, a community for a committed Christian, a certain set of core things that are necessary. Just like in a home, there are certain things that are necessary to make a home a home, a functional home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's got to be safe. It's got to be heated. It's got to have bedrooms, whatever. You know, you've got the structure, okay? But then there are also, when you think of a home, you're thinking about other intangibles that are a matter of individual taste, but makes the place feel warm and inviting and pleasant for you to be at. This is true in a home. This is also true in a church. What you've described to me seems largely to be more of these intangibles, because when it comes to the solid central issues of Christianity, your pastor's right there.
Mm-hmm.
He preaches the gospel and the word or whatever. But you told, if I caught you correctly, one of the things that helped you was not only Elisa Childers, but also R.C. Sproul.
Yes.
So if you go from R.C. Sproul to an AG church, that is a big cultural jump. And it's a theological jump too, you know. If you found yourself theologically at home with Sproul and kind of in a certain sense culturally comfortable, then when you go to an AG church, there's going to be a lot of things that are just going to rub you wrong, even though, you know, these are Christians that love the Lord and the gospel is being preached as and the Bible is being represented as the Word of God. These are the second order issues that are still really important. Okay?
Yeah.
So I think if you're looking for a church home, both need to be in place. The first thing is the foundation. That's absolutely first. And then the secondary things, that these intangibles that make it a warm home for you. Now, unfortunately, there are a lot of people who have that order reversed. They come to a place, they say, hey, I like it here. It feels good to me. I like the music. Right. I like the people. People are warm, fun. And that's all they're looking at. And they are not looking deeper at the underlying theology that drives that community. And that's the tail wagging the dog there. Make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And I can say, like, as I read my Bible, I wasn't looking for another theology. I guess you would say I was an Arminian until I read my Bible. I was a default Arminian.
Yeah.
Which is fine. I understand that we can have that disagreement and it shouldn't divide the body. And maybe because it's still so fresh to me, you know, I don't want to say that I'm overzealous. I just, when I hear certain things that I know other people are repeating only because they've heard it said that way, I get so anxious and I have to bite my tongue because I don't want to be.
So let me just sum it up.
And so I just find myself constantly biting my tongue and trying to quiet.
Yeah, yeah. See, that's not a good situation, all right? And so I'm going to make a final comment here, and then I got to run to other callers, but I'm not going to take any commercial breaks here because I just want to get to everybody. But it sounds to me like you're not comfortable in your home. That is your home church. And I think it would be a good idea to find another church with a solid biblical foundation, maybe like the church that you have, but we'll weigh in differently on some of the secondary issues and would be someplace that you feel more at home in light of just your own temperament and interests. Okay, Rochelle?
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Okay, the sum of what you've said, I think that pretty much caps it. I think you're just in the wrong home. So you think about that, okay?
I will. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate your call, Rochelle. Incidentally, Amy helped me out here. Brendan Eich was the CEO of Mozilla who got canned. It's the one I was talking about. Now, Amy, she tells me here that Red Pen Logic is not on YouTube. It's on the Red Pen Logic Facebook page, so you could go there. But when I want to see RPL, I just go to YouTube and type in Red Pen Logic, and that's how I find it. So maybe you can get it in both directions. I don't know. And right now, the RPL that is up that I just talked about today is a graphic. It's not a video. There's not a video attachment with it. It's just the graphic. So just saying. All right, let's go to – Thomas and Georgia, I'm coming back to you in just a minute because I think I want to spend more time with your question. But I want to go quickly to Canna in California because this touches a little bit, I think, on what our last caller had to say. Canna, is it Canna or Cana?
Canna, actually.
Canna.
How you doing, Greg?
Fine. I think we've talked before, haven't we?
No, actually.
Oh, okay.
But it's nice to talk to you.
I didn't think so. And it's nice to talk to you, too. Okay, Kana, what's on your mind?
Rochelle's issue is a little similar to mine, I guess. Uh-huh. I've attended a wonderful biblically sound church for quite some time now. I have no problems with their teaching, but with their worship, especially lately, they've been using more and more of music from Bethel Church.
Right.
And I'm sure you're familiar with...
Yes, the New Apostolic Reformation. Yeah, right. It's bad news in a word.
Yeah.
In two words.
And so that troubles me a bit, not to the point where I'm starting to look at other churches, but... It's a bit of a conundrum to have such a wonderful church, and yet their worship, plays Bethel music, and I assume that they have to pay some sort of license or something in order to play their music, and then thus, supporting what's going on up there.
Yeah, let me offer a thought quickly on that, because I think we can dispatch this fairly swiftly, and that is some people are going to feel uncomfortable because of the association, and you have to judge for yourself whether that discomfort is strong enough to disqualify your involvement in your current church, all right? So that is, I think, a personal judgment call. I actually don't think there is any necessary difficulty in singing a song which is beautiful and true. Now, I'm presuming both of those things. It's beautiful. I think worship should be beautiful, and a lot of worship is not beautiful nowadays, in my view. It's not melodic at all. But if it's beautiful and true and not banal, all right? Sometimes you can have Jesus is Lord, Jesus is Lord. You can say that 1,000 times. It's true, but it's banal. Just repeating it like that with very little heart.
Sure.
Yeah. So that's what I'm looking for, something that's true, something that's beautiful, and that's not banal, okay? It's one of the reasons I favor the older hymns. But it turns out one of the hymns that's my favorite, well, I can't think of the name right now, but it was written by a person who ended up abandoning the faith. And, wow. Okay, so he didn't hang in there. What do we think of this song? Well, the song is still wonderful. It's still a wonderful song. So I think you can, in the one sense, one can sing music from some artist who may even be godless, for goodness sake, if the music itself is sound and it is not tainted by its source. The only other thing that I would say is if the music that you sing a lot from Bethel begins to commend Bethel theology to people or Bethel as a church, that does become a problem. And so I would keep my eyes out here. But if a song gets in here or there, Hillsong is the same way. One of the main leaders there just defected from Christianity. you know.
Right.
And I'm not convinced that all of their theology is that always sound in their music or that whatever. It doesn't always satisfy my three requirements: truthful, beautiful, and not banal. You know, the music, beautiful, and the lyrics, not banal. So, you know, it's up to you, but that's my input. Okay, Kenna?
Very good. I appreciate it, and I appreciate you guys' ministry.
Okay, thanks so much. Thanks for your call, and let's clear the decks here and go finally to Thomas in Georgia. You made it.
Hey, Greg. It's an honor to speak to you.
It's nice to chat with you, too. Unfortunately, we have 6 minutes, and this looks like it might be a little bit philosophically complicated, so let's get right to it.
Okay, yeah, I have a relative who he's an atheist, and we've had discussions in the past about his worldview, and he's pretty much adopted Peter Singer, the philosopher's worldview, and we've had discussions about speciesism and objective morality.
Right.
And really, my question that I really wanted to hammer or get your knowledge about was about his view of objective morality.
Sure.
He seems to say that Peter Singer builds a case for objective morality without God. So, we've had some discussions, but just wanted to see what you thought.
Sure.
A way to kind of
I'll tell you quickly, I've heard some attempts that atheists have made to have objective morality, and it turns out what they end up citing is something objective, but what they cite is not morality, and that's the difficulty. And so I'll just say in advance, without hearing the argument yet, is that morality by its nature entails obligation. We are obliged to do something that is outside of ourselves, that is grounded outside of ourselves. If it's not grounded outside of ourselves, it is not objective. And if it does not entail obligation, ethical obligation, it's not morality. So quickly, give me a summary of Singer's case for objective morality without God, if you can.
Yeah, my understanding, and I haven't read too much on it, but what he has described to me is there's three axioms, and they seem to be based on fairness, and I guess for conscious beings, they're being for not only humans but also for animals.
Right.
They're being I guess the least amount of suffering for any conscious being. So that's what he's described to me. It kind of strikes me that this type of morality seems to be coming just from a man-made thought process, but
right.
I wasn't sure exactly how to, I guess, phrase that to him, or just a way to kind of
yes. Okay, let me respond because we just got 3 minutes left. Sorry, let me respond to this. This is really important. What they've done. This happens all the time in these kinds of discussions, and Singer's no slouch. I mean, he's got a PhD in philosophy, and he's at Yale or used to be, and what he's done is given three examples of things that we're morally obliged to do. Fairness to conscious beings, least suffering. Actually, there's two things there, fairness and least sufferings, and it applies to conscious beings, okay? Now, I don't know what fairness is, according to them. I'm not going to get into it right now, but I just want to point out these are the problems. What is fairness? That entails a certain definition of something, of how goods are distributed, okay? But it also smuggles in a moral obligation in trying to defend objective morality. Why is fairness, what is it that makes fairness a moral obligation? And why is it that we have to create the least amount of suffering? Why is that? Why can't we create the most amount of suffering? Now, people are going to say, well, it's just obvious that less suffering is better than more suffering. Well, better in what sense? Better in a pleasure sense? Yeah, it's better that way. But in a moral sense, that's another question. Even if they said it was obvious that it's better in a moral sense, they've confused some categories now. Because I would agree that it's better in a moral sense. I would say it's obviously better in a moral sense. However, That doesn't tell us why it's obligatory for us to do that. It tells us that we know it's better, but to whom or to what are we morally obliged? Okay. We are morally obliged regarding conscious beings, according to Peter Singer, but who is obliging us regarding conscious beings? This is called the grounding question, and I confess, you know, the shortness of time here at the end of the show, I'm just kind of throwing this out. We've talked about it a lot before in different circumstances, but I just, in fact, there's an issue of Sala Grande wrote this year called The Primal Heresy, and you can read that. It was March issue, and I talk about this a little bit, about what relativism is. But morality entails obligation. Objective morality is obligation that comes from without, from the outside. So when I say, I think God is the moral standard of the universe, and he creates moral principles to who, and I am obliged to him to obey these moral principles, I have just grounded and made sense of my moral obligation in an objective sense. Now, regardless of anybody accepts that or not, my point is I have just grounded it in a sound way. Peter Singer is not grounding it in any way. He seems to me just to be declaring that fairness is a moral good. Who says? His grandmother? Did he just make that up? Is that his culture's view, that we shouldn't have suffering for people? He said, well, it's obvious we shouldn't. And yes, it's obvious that we shouldn't, but the point I'm making is not how we know it, that it's obvious, but what causes it to be wrong. That's the grounding issue. And this is what no amount of atheistic thinking can accomplish for morality. It simply cannot ground objective obligation in a godless world. Period. So that's the best I can do in my 7 minutes or whatever, Thomas. I appreciate your call, and I hope that helped a little bit. Check out that issue of Solid Ground, The Primal Heresy, because there I talk about relativism, and I've done a lot of other writing about it as well. In any event, that's it for this hour, friends. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye, friends.